This winter, the New Hampshire legislature considered a bill to tax electric vehicles to fund state road maintenance. It didn't pass, but made me realize how common and often persuasive false dichotomies are in politics, and in this case, equating electric vehicle use with road damage, for instance. Another more serious debate occurring right now in New Hampshire is that we need new gas infrastructure, or we are going to face winter energy insecurity and possibly rolling blackouts. How can we combat false simplification of our choices and the manipulation of the news cycle and our representatives?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if I can answer the manipulation of the news cycle, but let me start with the initial question on dichotomies by going back and saying that this is something that we really need to figure out, right? We need to transition from the tyranny of or to the opportunity of and. We can no longer think about it's the economy versus the environment, especially here in New England. It's the economy and the environment. So let's speak to the issue of natural gas. This is something that I spent a year-long research project working on with the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire. And what is clear is that we don't have a shortage of natural gas or natural gas pipelines. We just have a perverted market for natural gas. So the answer, we have enough pipelines to deliver the natural gas that we need here to New England. Their challenge becomes on really cold days when people are using natural gas to heat their homes because they've contracted for the natural gas. The price of natural gas spikes. And it's actually, the solution is actually quite straightforward, is you just have to have a different type of fuel on hand to run our power stations so that we don't have to use natural gas. Fuel switching. It's actually a system that has worked quite well in that we have not had the huge price spikes occur again that we had during the winter of 2013 and 2014. So that's the solution. The risk is that if you put a whole bunch of money, especially public money, into natural gas pipelines, there's no guarantee that we will recoup that money. So these are called stranded costs. And I can tell you, New Hampshire has some prime examples of stranded costs, and they're driving our electricity rates up. And the biggest one that I can think of, the biggest travesty, is actually the Bow Power Plant. So I was involved in a significant debate in 2009 and 2010 on whether or not we should put mercury scrubbers on the Bow Power Plant. We pushed back and said, yes, we need to clean up the air, but Bow Power Plant is not going to be making energy for a long time. So why would we invest $450 million to put those scrubbers into the Bow Power Plant? Well, there was a lot of people that wanted the jobs, and so we went ahead and spent that $450 million. Bow Power Plant rarely operates today, and when it was just sold by Eversource, its value was placed at something for the entire power plant at $75 million. You know who's paying that difference? Stranded costs. So I think we need to think very carefully before we put any public money behind a natural gas pipeline, because I think it is, in that sense, an economic issue. And we certainly have to be very aware of the stranded costs. And I just don't think that our state government should be picking winners and losers in the energy market.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Following along on the supply of electrical energy, what part does nuclear power play in sustainability and reducing CO2 production?
All right, great question. And you added the sustainability word in there, which makes it a lot harder. It's Selena and I live across from the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, and we store all of that nuclear waste from those submarines on site. So it's an issue that's close to my heart. But I will say I have mixed emotions about nuclear power. So there's two ways that I think about this. Let me share my dilemma with you. First and foremost, nuclear power really is not very economical. And you need look no further from the fact that nuclear power plants don't pay for the insurance on their power plants. We pay for it. If there is a big nuclear disaster, it is the federal government that pays, right? So they can't cover their insurance. And the cost of big new nuclear power plants is exorbitant. So I've been hearing for years that there's these wonderful new small nuclear power plants that are going to come online, but we're not there yet. So from an economic perspective, it's challenging. We have not figured out where to put the waste, right? You can't get a building permit in Peterborough without actually figuring out where your waste from your house is going to go. So why do we allow nuclear power plants to build and continue to operate when we have nowhere to put that waste fuel? So we need to figure that issue out. And there's also the issue of sort of radioactive material and terrorism. On the flip side, I think nuclear power plants are a really important transition to the renewable future because they provide really important baseload. So if they're already built and they're already generating electricity, we should keep them operational until we can get to a renewable energy system. And I would value that far more over building new natural gas pipelines, right? We don't need to invest in new infrastructure. We need to use the existing infrastructure till we don't need it anymore. And again, so my approach on this is let's not develop a whole bunch of fossil fuel infrastructure that is going to be obsolete, probably really expensive and stranded over time. So I think it's a part of the short-term solution and a short-term bridge. I personally don't think we should be building a lot more nuclear power plants as I see how quickly solar and wind is coming along, and then the holy grail of renewables, right, is going to be storage. And once we get that figured out, we're just not going to need nuclear to the extent that we have needed it in the past.
Okay. You mentioned briefly the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil. Their influence on the conversation is obvious. How do we depoliticize the topic of climate change?
How do we depoliticize the topic of climate change? So that's a really significant challenge because it has been, I would say, almost weaponized over the course of the past decade. I'm sure as good New Hampshire residents, you will all remember when John McCain ran for president and he came in here and fully acknowledged that A, humans were driving warming planet, and B, we had to do something about it. And then something happened to the Republican Party. It changed rather dramatically. I think we do have to depoliticize it, and I think what we need to do is actually spend more time listening and less time lecturing, and we need to figure out what our common vision is with people who have different perspectives on the issue of climate change. Our friends and our family who are on the other side of this issue are not going to be now be persuaded by data. Right, it's not about a large logical discussion about data. Like, we've been doing that for 30 years as scientists, and the people who get it are responding to that wealth of information. So at some point, I think we need to transition to having those personal conversations from the heart about what is it that we value, and then from that perspective of what we value, think about getting to a place where we can work together for the future that we want. This is a significant challenge and one that we need to continue to work on. But again, this is not climate science is not going to do this for us. It's really going to be that conversation and that decision one at a time.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say there's so many amazing questions here. It's very difficult to choose. But this one is, please say more about changes needed in agriculture and food systems.
All right, another great question. So I think in terms of our food system, pardon the pun, low-hanging fruit, that we really have to solve right away is food waste across the system, right? Estimates are something on the order to we waste a quarter to a third of our food in this country. And that's just unacceptable. We have to figure out how to transition. A few other aspects is that we know that that our love of red meat, but especially beef, really contributes significantly to the issue of climate change because cows burp methane, essentially. And so one of the transitions is that I think that beef needs to be de-emphasized in our diet, and that we need to emphasize especially vegetables. I think that's a hard sell for a lot of people. And I know that America is all about personal choice. So I think we can help drive choice in that direction. So I don't think it's about everybody has to be vegan. I don't think that's ever going to work. I think it's about, like, can you reduce the amount of beef consumption? And can you raise your consumption of vegetables? And by the way, it's going to make us all healthier too. So there's a win-win there. In terms of carbon, in terms of agricultural practices, I think there's, and again, I'm an ice core scientist, right? So I read about this stuff. This is not an area of expertise, but certainly the ongoing effort to develop no-till farming, so that you're not sort of turning over that land and emitting all of that carbon and nitrous oxide out of the soils, that you're really keeping it in the soils. We need to do far more to actually continue for those soils to be sinks of carbon. That's really important. And there's probably about 150 more ideas that I don't know about, but I know that it's a really important part of the solution.
Many questions about the involvement of young people. I'm going to read a couple. What site would be good to educate first, second, and third graders on this? Can you tell us about the young people you're working with? And basically, can you tell the gray-haired people in the audience about what they can do with their grandchildren to begin to address this issue?
You know, what can we do for our young people? I'm not going to provide you with specifics, but I'm going to provide you with something general that I hope helps. When we talk about sort of sustainable learning objectives at the University of New Hampshire, we really think about two things. One is taking a systems approach. So whatever you do with children, what I would encourage you to do is to start having them see the system, whether that is a watershed, or whether, I've immediately jumped to sort of outdoor experiences because that's where I got most of my best education. But I think about watersheds, I think about growing food and the importance of really good soil. I think about the way that your house works and the heating and cooling that you do there. If we can have our children understand systems, they are going to much better understand the challenges we face instead of just thinking about temperature or a flood. They're gonna think about it more broadly together. I hope that helps. In terms of wonderful students I'm working with at the University of New Hampshire, I'm just really privileged to help organize and run a sustainability fellows program. So we have 23 fellows from across the nation actually now working across New England. They're working with municipalities and they're working with nonprofit organizations and they're working with businesses to help those entities figure out how to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions or how to adapt to climate change. And I think the most powerful aspect of the program is that we set this up as a mentor-mentee relationship, that we have one-on-one mentors for every one of those students who introduce them to the problem, provide a network when they have questions, and sort of help support them so they can help come up with solutions for that home entity. And the bigger part of that effort is we now have 120 alumni of this program, and so we are now building the network of future leaders that actually understand that sustainability is difficult and a big challenge, but they now have 120 people they can pick up the phone and call and say, hey, I know you had to deal with that. And so our approach on that front has really been to build a network of professionals that understand sustainability, understand systems, and have the network to actually address these really big challenges. And maybe Peterborough can apply for one next year.
So this will be our final question for today. And again, I invite everyone to come and ask more questions of the speaker after the formal presentation. I've decided to bring it down back to personal. We've talked about the system approach, but this person says, thank you for the changes you have made in your home. Why do you continue to live in a car community away from where you work? This is challenging for many of us. Please use your personal situation to address this much larger issue.
That's it. I guess in some sense we're all hypocrites, right? And so I justify having a car in part because of the good work that I am doing. My preference would be not to have a car that emits any greenhouse gas emissions. We get really good mileage in the car that we have, but it's not enough. I don't think we solve the problem by completely transforming ourselves individually. It's not enough. As a community, we need to change. And therefore, we need to engage and participate. And so my work at the University of New Hampshire, which I drive to, but I also take the bus and I ride to, the time that I spend with you here today requires that I use the systems that are available to me to do that. And I would argue that that engagement right now is much more important than me not engaging because I don't want to burn fossil fuels. It is a challenge that I fight with every day, and I strive to be better, but we can't just sort of, you know, put on our net zero hat and hide in our homes. It's not enough. We need to change society, and that requires us to engage.
Thank you very much. So thank you, Dr. Cameron Wake. Thank you again, Dr. Cameron Wake, for sharing your time and expertise and your personal story as well with us today. And I'd also like to thank our lively audience and those listening today on NHPR or on a podcast. You make all the difference. Our program next Sunday will feature Adar Cohen with his topic, Falling Asleep to Gunfire, Violence in Chicago, A Country's Slumbering Response, and How Gang Members Become Peacekeepers. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Peterborough Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Monadnock Summer Lyceum lecture series, visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org and stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook.